You are listening to a session from the Sunstone 2013 Salt Lake City Symposium at the University of Utah. This particular session was recorded on August 1st, 2013, and is titled Redefining Chastity, A Path Towards Healthy, Empowered, and Morally Excellent Choices, featuring Lisa Butterworth. Sunstone depends on your generous support to fund projects like this podcast and other important endeavors in Mormon culture, scholarship, and restorationist pursuits. Please consider a donation at sunstonemagazine.com.
Welcome to Sunstone 112. This is Lisa Butterworth. We're going to be listening to her presentation, Redefining Chastity, A Path Towards Healthy, Empowered, and Morally Excellent Choices. Lisa Butterworth is the founder of Feminist Mormon Housewives and a graduate student in counseling. She teaches Sunday school, plays lots of munchkin with her munchkins, and is equally yoked for time and eternity with a totally righteous provider. She's also worn out at least 4 vacuums.
It's a powerful resume.
I wasn't sure if y'all would catch the vacuum reference. Do you guys know where that's from?
No.
Sister Dalton at conference last April gave a talk in which she talked about wearing out a vacuum in the conference center, and it was kind of a touchstone for Mormon feminists because she was just talking about how, you know, everybody has a role, and so it's a little bit risky to talk about how women's role is vacuuming, you know, in a feminist context. But so I thought that was pretty funny when I wrote it. So, anyway, I feel like I'm in a little bit of a tricky spot with this paper because I know that my audience here at Sunstone, we're all quirky Mormons because we're here, right? So, you know, we're the so-called intellectuals and the feminists and the gays and the middleway Mormons and the ex-Mormons and the post-Mormons and every other brand of non-standard Mormon available. So when I speak to the problem with the church's current approach to chastity in the setting, I know that I am preaching to the choir. And it's unlikely that there are many people in this room likely to jump up to the podium to defend the church's perfect track record on the subject. But I also have a very different intention in writing this paper. In going through the process of taking apart our Mormon ideas about chastity and piecing them back together in a healthier way, I don't want to convince you that changes need to be made. I don't need to convince you. My friends are the choir. And I am preaching to you. So my goal, rather, today is to speak to the women who would likely jump to the podium to defend the church's perfection, to speak to women who are teaching my daughters and young women's. I want to write a paper that my Orthodox mother would find interesting and compelling. I want to write a paper that might make my conservative Sunday school teachers stop and think and reconsider perhaps the way she talks to her kids about chastity, which means I have to take a different road than the one I might take if I were speaking just to you, my quirky Mormon friends. I don't want to talk out of both sides of my mouth, and I don't believe that's what I'm doing. I truly believe that chastity can and should be taught in a way that will empower our youth and help us Mormons to make wise sexual choices. I personally think chastity is an important part of Mormon theology, and one I don't want to see discarded. I just think we need to look carefully at what we teach as chastity to assure that we are teaching correct principles and teaching them in a healthy and positive manner. I think we must carefully look at the way we have been teaching chastity and ask ourselves, is there a better way to do it? Are there better ways to do it? And I believe that there are. I know many of you quirky Mormons probably aren't the biggest fans of the very concept of chastity, because I, too, am a heterodox Mormon with a congenital lack of certainty about anything at all. I personally think certainty is by definition antithetical to faith. I think that questioning the utility of chastity, or really the utility of any value, is an undertaking worthy of discussion and deep thought and meditation and debate. I have actually thought about chastity deeply and come down on the side of chastity, though not chastity, quote unquote, in the sense that it's often taught in the church context. Fuller discussion on that in a moment. But for all the logic that one might employ in the debate about chastity, ultimately, and more to the point, I suppose, chastity is not a matter of utility for most Mormons, at least not fully or solely a matter of utility. But it is at its core, chastity is probably and should be a matter of faith. And because it's a matter of faith, a discussion that focuses only on the usefulness or uselessness, I suppose, of chastity is not a discussion my mother would find compelling. Usefulness alone, by itself, is beside the point to some degree. Certainly my mother would argue that chastity is useful, but no set of logical arguments or compelling statistics indicating otherwise would sway my mother's faith in chastity. My mother believes with certainty. She believes in chastity with certainty. And a debate about chastity's merits on a practical level alone approaches something close to taboo. And I kind of think of this like, you know, if it's not a taboo you share, it's kind of hard to understand. But a taboo we kind of all share is, consider if someone came up to you and asked to buy your children, right? There's not necessarily a logical reason why you can't do that, like depending on what set of logical parameters you're using. But it's not something you can, even if you know your child's going to be treated really well, even if you know your child's going to have even a maybe better life than you could give your child, contemplating how much you could sell your child for isn't something you can really do. It's a taboo that we all understand. And for my mom, thinking about how useful is chastity, is it really useful? Could it be useless? That's a taboo that she just can't even approach because it's just not something, you know, God said this is the way it's going to be, and you don't question that. So, some things go beyond logic for all of us. We are not purely logical creatures, and I would argue that that's actually a good thing, as wise and moral decisions require more than logic. Actually, one of the things that's interesting about logic is that our brains are kind of limited into how many things we can logic out. Like, when we're making a logical decision, we can only weigh two or three things at a time. And some decisions require really vastly complex things to be weighed, like buying a car or house or whether you're going to have children or who you're going to marry. And trying to make those choices logically, it doesn't work. People whose logic centers of their brain get broken, they make terrible decisions. They can't decide which cereal they want because, you know, there's no real logical way to make that decision. And so, you know, like, I think as quirky Mormons, we can get really into the idea of logic, but one of the themes that I'm going to have in this whole paper is the idea of balance between competing parts of our brain and competing paradoxical sort of paradoxical dilemmas where we have to find balance between these things. And I think the balance between using logic and using spirituality and emotion and those kinds of things, that's one of those paradoxes that there's no real easy balance to. Because my mother believes that God says that chastity is important, it doesn't matter how much harm you can demonstrate, no amount of logic or persuasion matters in the face of a deep, certain foundational belief. This is a divide that I think creates a wall between us. We, the sun-stoned Mormons, say things like the church's modesty and chastity rhetoric are hurting people. And my mom hears, those people want to sin and have sex and wear sexy, sexy clothes. So what we have here is a clash of values. And not necessarily the values themselves. Because as it turns out, not every sun-stoned Mormon actually wants to go out and have lots of sex and wear miniskirts. What we have here is not a clash of the value themselves, but rather something deeper, a difference in our underlying approach to the values. We talk past each other because, while on the surface, it looks like we're both discussing the same thing, namely chastity, modesty, virtue. We, the quirky Mormon side, see it as a matter of functional values. We argue logically for something more functional, whereas my mom, on the more orthodox side, sees it as a matter of absolute values, given directly from God, no argument required. So I tend to approach things very functionally, personally. My first instinct is to figure out what works scientifically. Anecdotally, through study and thought, I want to figure out solutions. My values are based in very practical considerations of what's most effective, what causes the least harm, what helps people the most. These things are values. These are values. They're functional values. In my mind, this approach to values is the functional equivalent of the scripture adage, by their fruits you shall know them. We are told to look at the fruit over and over in our scriptures and by our prophets, and I think that this requires us to use the tools at our disposal. In fact, President Uchtdorf gave a talk not too long ago about using logic, judging things by their fruits. It was a great talk.
it's
I believe that God gave us logic and study and science as valuable tools to be used in conjunction with our spirituality and our empathy and positive emotions like love. But this practical approach to values can feel downright disconcerting and even taboo to folks with more absolute fundamentalist literal approaches to faith. They will accuse someone like me of having no values or of being subject to the hellish depravity of moral relativism. To many folks, values such as chastity are absolute. Any harm that might be caused by them, by the way we discuss chastity or modesty, can be dismissed or justified or explained away because the value itself is fundamentally certain. So this approach, this underlying difference between a functional approach and an absolute approach. Sorry. This fundamental difference between a functional approach and an absolute approach makes it easy and almost inevitable for folks on either side of the divide to talk past each other endlessly. And I think if we are to make any progress in convincing our family and friends and young men and young women leaders to listen to our concerns about values like chastity and modesty and virtue, we need to approach them where they are, which means not to question the foundational importance of these values. That is, not to call into question the absolute importance of chastity, but rather to affirm chastity and to speak for and to seek for a deeper understanding of why the ways chastity have been taught in the past has caused so much harm, and how we can teach it in the future in a manner that will encourage positive health and healthy sexual choices. And so this is going to be my approach. I'm not going to question the absolute nature of the value of chastity in this essay. Not that that's not a legitimate task for someone else, but it's not the approach that aligns with my purpose, nor with my own faith rooted in certainty, though my own faith is. I see a deep and hidden divide between what most Mormons of the Orthodox and heterodox variety would believe to be the ideal and true meaning of chastity and the way that we use these words in everyday discussion and the way that kids are picking up on them. As I asked a random sampling of young women that I personally know, my daughter's friends, what do chastity and virtue mean to you? The answers generally went something like this, and they had this slightly uncomfortable panic look that sort of switched to a carefully thoughtful look, followed by some veiled euphemisms, purity and integrity. And I think at this point, the girls were hoping for the standard Sunday school pat on the head, but I persisted. Well, what does it mean, purity and integrity? And sometimes I'd get another euphemism, striving to be clean and wholesome. And it always ended with a question at the end. But eventually, all roads led to one single answer, not having sex before you're married. I think that's fairly close to what Mormons mean in shorthand when we talk about chastity, with one small clarification. There are a whole broad range of activities beyond sexual intercourse that we Mormons would not consider virtuous behavior. I think it's safe to say that to the general Mormon audience, chastity means not having sex outside of marriage, and also not doing, reading, watching anything close to or pertaining to sex outside of marriage, or in other words, maintaining a high standard of sexual innocence. There are several layers of problems with this understanding of chastity. There's the problem of euphemism and vagueness. There's the problem of equating virginity and innocence and ignorance with purity and chastity. There's sort of a fundamental problem with the way that we apply purity to girls and their sexual history. But first I want to talk about the problem of euphemism, and we can return to the other points a little later on. We Mormons rarely talk about things bluntly. I don't think I've ever heard the word sexual intercourse said outright in a Mormon context. But we all know, or we think we know, what it means when someone says chastity or virtue. We know it's about sex, or rather about not having sex or anything like it. But that does that mean specifically? What does that mean specifically? Does thinking about sex count? Are sexual thoughts and sexual are all sexual thoughts and all sexual impulses sinful? Are we impure and unclean for simply having desires, even if we don't act on them? And if I do act on them at some point, when do those actions cross the line from being a small transgression into a soul-destroying sin, second only to murder? And how does one properly transition into being sexually, being a sexual person after marriage? And that's not even getting close to the problem of abuse and the unwilling loss of innocence and rape and, And so the problem is that one of the biggest problems is that adults don't feel comfortable answering these questions candidly, if they even know the answers to the questions themselves. And most of the kids would never dare ask. Frankness about sexual matters itself is often seen as a transgression of chastity. We worry that by talking about sex too specifically, we can damage the purity and innocence of the children we are teaching, or even our own purity and innocence. Or worse, we could encourage them to act upon the things we've said. And I think we often view chastity as a bubble of innocence and ignorance that will protect our children from the outside influences of the world. And in some ways, I can understand that view. We are bombarded with messages about sex, from beer commercials to television and movies, books and social media. Short of locking ourselves in a bunker in Montana, we are going to get all kinds of unhealthy and unwise and morally bankrupt messages about sexuality. They're just everywhere. I know as a mother, it's my natural impulse to want to protect my kids. I don't want them to lose their innocence. They're just so pure. And I think the impulse to try and keep your kids pure like that for as long as possible is really understandable. But the problem is this bubble is impossible. You know, we can't create a bubble of chastity that protects our children. And so unless we lock ourselves in that bunker, we are going to be hearing about sex all the time. And our kids are going to be hearing about it on the playground and in the locker room, and they're going to be hearing about it every time they turn on the TV or go to Facebook. They just are. So we can't create a bubble of chastity safety for our children. Ignorance will not protect us or keep us innocent. The only real protection we can have and the only protection we can give our kids is by giving them tools to deal with these messages, by giving them knowledge, by giving them empowerment. And having useful, meaningful knowledge means we have to go beyond vagueness and euphemism. We need to be specific with ourselves and each other in what constitutes serious transgression. We need to be informed as a community and as individuals what abuse looks like, and to teach our kids that it's not their fault. And to do that, we have to stop assuming that all sexual knowledge is wrong or impure, and we have to stop seeing virtue in ignorance. I think that that's the biggest problem. We think that ignorance is virtuous. We often see teaching chastity what we often see as teaching chastity is not teaching chastity at all, but rather a fear of sex. Fear of talking too frankly about sex will harm our kids. Fear that we will degrade something special and sacred by discussing it too openly or too lightly. Fear that we will be judged by others for not conforming to the expectations that we just don't talk about those things so openly, especially not in a church setting. And because of that fear, the way we talk about chastity and about sex is not empowering to us to make wise, informed, and moral choices, but rather emphasizing our discomfort with sex, our avoidance of sex, our shame about sex. And if I haven't made a compelling argument yet for bringing more discussion of sexuality out into the open, then consider this. Presuming it were possible to protect ourselves through innocence and ignorance from culture in the sex-obsessed and irreverent world without going weird on isolation in our bunker in Montana, what would the ideal Mormon world look like? Would it be sexless? Would there be no mention of sex in books or in movies? Would sex never be the subject in artwork? Would no scientist ever study sex? Would no encyclopedia or dictionaries or self-help manuals ever mention that sex exists? Because I know real people, I think, who imagine a world like this would be a better one, or, you know, see all sexual knowledge as sinful and dangerous. If this could be accomplished, is this what we would want? Can we even imagine such a world? Personally, I find the idea of such a world deeply disturbing. We are embodied beings, getting bodies, learning how to dwell in our bodies. That's why we're here. We are here to be tested, and part of that testing is learning to be embodied. You know, one of the defining characteristics of Mormonism, actually, was, you know, the early kind of separation of Mormons from other brands of Christians in the fact that we believe in an embodied God, and we believe in embodied parents, parent gods, and we believe that our body is so important that it's actually a part of our souls. We have been, this is a talk by Elder James Talmadge from 1913. And this is, you know, sort of some pretty basic sort of body talk, especially in this time period. We have been taught to look upon these bodies as gifts from God. We Latter-day Saints do not regard the body as something to be condemned, something to be abhorred. We regard the body as a sign of our royal birthright. We recognize that those who kept not their first estate were denied this inestimable blessing. We believe that these bodies may be made in truth the temples of the Holy Ghost. It is peculiar to the theology of the Latter-day Saints that we regard the body as an essential part of the soul. We are taught that the solemn and eternal truth that the soul of man is the body and the spirit combined. So God designed these bodies. Our bodies are an eternal part of our soul, and God designed us. It is our bodies as sexual beings. We believe that both are vital. And so if we hate our bodies, anybody in this room guilty of that? No? I am, sometimes. If we are uncomfortable in our bodies, if we can't learn how our bodies work, including a healthy sexuality, then we're refusing to embrace the knowledge, the sexual knowledge, that God intended us to learn in this mortal probation. We can't learn through ignorance and innocence. Certainly there are subjects that aren't appropriate for children. It is wise to present sexual information to children in an age-appropriate way, but the idea that adults should remain childlike in this one area, sexuality, and yet continue to learn and grow in all other areas does not seem to be supported by our doctrine or by common sense. And yet I personally know many full-grown LDS women who refuse to read any book not written for young adults for fear they might accidentally read something inappropriate. All the great literature of the world is close to them because they mistake fear and ignorance for virtue. Similarly, I know many LDS women who refuse to learn about things like sex slavery and human trafficking because they feel the topic is inappropriate. And again, if we are speaking of children, certainly there's a value to protecting the innocence of children, but treating ourselves, adult men and women, as though we are harmed or made impure simply by gaining greater knowledge of the very real suffering and horror that takes place in the world, presuming that for the sake of our own purity, we must turn our backs on suffering of the innocent children and women who are subject to these horrible things, that sounds more like selfishness than chastity to me. I cannot believe that what the Lord intends for us is to believe in or strive for innocence that facilitates the suffering of others. Take, for instance, our own Mormon sister, Elizabeth Smart. After her own experience of being kidnapped and raped, she started a foundation to speak out against human trafficking. It's patently absurd that such an activity would be a stain upon her chastity. And yet, as a young woman, I showed interest in doing some research in a service project on that topic when Elizabeth Smart was probably a baby or not even born yet, for a personal progress project. And my mother and my young women's leaders rejected my research as inappropriate. They told me, no, don't do that. It will, you know, that's not an appropriate topic for a young woman. And I wasn't 12, you know, I was 16. I was old enough. I presumed at the time that they wanted to protect my innocence, but they were really teaching me, what they really taught me, was that my purity and my innocence and my ignorance was something that learning could harm. And it was more important than caring about others and helping others. A world in which all references to sexuality disappeared, a world in which no scientists studied sexuality, there were no innocent young women researching sex slavery, a world in which no artists explored the deeper spiritual meanings of sex, a world in which no sex counselors worked to help others find healthy ways of engaging sexually with each other. I do not think this is the world God intended us to strive for. We are here to learn, and we are here to help others. A world in which sex is never mentioned sounds more like a world in which we are here to not learn. I know the fear is that when I say we have to learn about sex in order to learn the lessons of mortality, that I'm trying to give license to any kind of behavior that one could reasonably justify as educational. Not at all. I think perhaps one of the biggest lessons and one of the hardest lessons we need to learn about our sexuality and even about gaining knowledge is that it has to be used carefully. There is a difference between studying sex trafficking with the intention of gaining understanding of the suffering of the world and perhaps doing something to make it better, and studying sex trafficking because we find the topic titillating and entertaining. Oops, that's my alarm telling me to give my daughter a medicine. Sorry. I'm not going to be giving her medicine this morning. A person could read the exact same material, and in one case, this would be a positive moral choice, and in the other, it would be a really negative moral choice. And I think that ambiguity is, again, one of the fears we let control the way we talk and learn about chastity. We want clear-cut lines that keep us from accidental sin. We have this fear that, like, if we don't keep within the boundaries, then we can accidentally do something wrong. And that's true of every kind of Mormon sort of sin. We really like checklists, and we really like boundaries. And I do think that checklists and boundaries can be helpful, but when we try and simplify everything into checklists and boundaries, we do ourselves a great disservice. We like to think it's safer to avoid all books and movies that might mention sex instead of maturely sifting through material and determining which materials treat sexuality with seriousness and respect and can teach us something deeper and more meaningful about our lives as sexual human beings versus materials created to sell products or exploit. This does not require us to watch every rated R movie or sift through the dregs of the internet in search of deeper understanding of our sexual natures. But the idea of avoidance of any potentially adult material is the idea that this is safer or morally superior to a thoughtful consideration of the content on its own merit is a really popular Mormon notion. But is the choice to remain ignorant really a morally superior one? I think this is a notion that we as a culture need to think deeply about. And I think, as with everything, the answer lies in moderation and balance. Sex and learning about sex should be part of our lives. We need to learn about sex because we are sexual beings, and learning about our souls, our body, and our spirit combined is the whole point. Even if we're not married and therefore in a position to act on the fact that we are sexual beings, knowing about your body and striving a way to understand your sexuality in a healthy way is something we as people need to strive to understand. And understanding does not arise from fear and avoidance and ignorance. I certainly don't have all the answers about how to find the correct balance, or how to know when you've crossed the line from knowledge-seeking into harmful self-indulgence. That's the tricky part about balance. It's a journey without clear boundaries and requires self-awareness and mindfulness and a close relationship with the spirit. And there will be mistakes and setbacks and regrettable learning experiences, and it's scary to make mistakes. And we want to be perfect. It's so much easier to be perfect if we never venture out and learn hard things. But even those mistakes are preferable, I think, to willful ignorance. The Lord knew our quest for knowledge would result in mistakes. And yet, he still gave us agency, and I think that's a really important part of Mormon theology. He commanded us to go out in the world and learn and be tested and risk making those mistakes, to learn from them, to repent. That's the point of atonement. I think the notion of purity, moving on to purity, is one we also need to look at closely. Mormon doctrine is clear on the point that repentance and atonement are foundational. Anyone who sorrows for their sins and truly repents is no longer unworthy. And it's also clear, and, you know, that's outlined in, you know, our materials, but it's not emphasized as much. You know, the obedience and the don't sin, stay far away from sin as possible, those are really pounded home in our, like, teaching materials and the stuff that's handed out in Sunday school lessons. But if you look at, you know, the writings of prophets, that's not necessarily the foundation. You know, it's what we have been choosing to emphasize for the last few decades, but it's not necessarily, I think, foundational to the gospel that way. It's also clear that the notion of women and children who have been subject to abuse are not responsible and have not sinned and need not repent, and that's in the church handbook, also in the For Strength of Youth manual. And I think that generally moms and women leaders try to point that out, but it's sort of, you know, roulette whether you get a young women leader who's teaching repentance and teaching, you know, emphasizing that nobody is truly ever lost. Many of you may be familiar with Elizabeth Smart's experience. She came out a few months ago and was talking about her at a child trafficking conference. She talked about her experiences. And she, I'll just read a little bit. "I felt like my soul had been crushed. I felt like I wasn't even human anymore. How could anyone want me or love me or care about me? I felt like life had no meaning in it. It's feelings of self-worth. It's feelings of who would ever want me now? I'm worthless. That was it for me the first time I was raped." And she talks about how in school she learned about, imagine you're a stick of gum, and when you engage in sex, that's like being chewed. And if you do that lots of time, you become an old piece of gum. And who would you want you after that? This is still her talking. That's terrible. Nobody should ever say that. But for me, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that chewed up piece of gum. Nobody would choose a piece of gum. You throw it away. And I think this is a really common misapplication of the notion of purity. I struggle with the notion of purity at all because it's an Old Testament notion that is really tied up in food as well. And, you know, when we talk about purity in food, we talk about food becoming tainted. And nobody wants tainted food. You know, an interesting analogy is the idea of, you know, if you take a glass of water and take it out and then spit in it, even though that spit was just in your mouth, nobody wants to drink that glass of water now, even though, I mean, just a moment ago, it was you yourself. And, you know, they've done experiments where they will take somebody's, just a little bit of something that's really not going to be, you know, like a little tiny bit of poo, and put it in a glass of water and stir it up and ask somebody to drink it. And obviously they're going to say no. And then they boil the water and they say, now we drink it. And even though we all know logically it's perfectly safe, we feel like the purity of that water has been violated and we can't drink it, even though all the water we ever drink has some old poo in it. But that notion of purity, when it is applied that way towards somebody's sexual history, is always going to be harmful because there's really nothing that can wipe clean. I mean, we have the notion of atonement, but anytime we use that purity notion, you know, we have serious, like, purity instincts because we don't want to be poisoned. And so when we use a notion that's connected to food like that to connect it to chastity, it's generally going to be really harmful. And so as I've thought about, like, how can we use purity in a way that because I don't think that Mormons are going to give up the notion of purity. I don't think that we necessarily even should. But I think what we have to do is shift the way that we talk about it, just like I think we need to shift the way we talk about, you know, chastity. And so I think we need to apply purity inwardly, like purity of intention. Like we need to learn to check our own self-awareness, our reflection of our actions and motivations. We should never apply the notion of purity to a person's worth. We have divine nature. Our worth cannot be damaged. But I think it is a worthwhile exercise to look inward and to try and figure out our motivations and the reasons why we do things, because we all sometimes have impure motivations. We're all sometimes feeling selfish or angry or bitter or whatever. And so, you know, if we can apply the notion of purity of intent, I think that can be a useful way to use purity. And this next part, because I'm traveling, I lost the last version of my chastity equals virginity, the polished version. So I have all the notes, so you're going to get the unpolished version. So the notion that we started with was that chastity equals virginity. And historically, obviously, this is a really common perception. But I think as Mormons, if you ask, somebody who really knows what they're talking about with chastity, if you're talking to a Mormon, they're not going to say chastity equals purity or chastity equals virginity. Generally speaking, they're going to acknowledge that if you get raped or if you repent, that, you know, you can still live a chaste life. But, you know, just like with the young women that I talked to, the connection is there. And there was a recent There was a recent survey of young women that came out on the internet. I think, John Dillon had something to do with it. But when they asked young women, what is chastity? Is it virginity? Can you be chaste if you've had sex? The numbers were 75-80% of girls said, no, you can't be chaste if you've had sex. No, yes, chastity is virginity. And so this is a message that our girls are clearly getting, even though I don't think that it suits Mormon theology very well. One reason why I don't think it suits Mormon theology very well, it's just the basic human rights reason. I mean, historically speaking, virginity is a commodity. It's something you can buy and sell. It's something that, gave a woman her worth. And as we've talked about earlier, that's really not the correct notion of Mormonism. Our worth is in our divine nature, not in our sexual history. And further, virginity has a history of just being totally sexist. There's never been a history of male virginity being worth something, ever. And so, there's this terrible sexual double standard where it becomes a commodification of all of the big words are making me stumble today. Commodification of female bodies, whereas it's never been that for men. I think that as Mormons, I've never heard, the equivalent within Mormon culture where, oh, girls, you have to keep yourself chaste. Boys, you can go out and do whatever the heck you want. That I've never heard that taught. There are some imbalances in the way we approach teaching chastity in that, girls get a lot of body shame for modesty. Girls get a lot of body shame for, oh, don't be walking pornography. There's also, a lot of shame that will be attached to a girl who gets pregnant, a lot of consequences that will happen in her ward and in her life, that there is no equivalent for the boys. A boy who fathers a child unmarried isn't going to have to leave his young men's class, whereas a girl who gets pregnant will be sent to the adult relief society. And so, there's a lot of shame and treatment that's not equal, but on a theological level, we don't think that, girls can have to be virgins and boys can do whatever the heck they want. Now, after the Elizabeth Smart scandal, there was a really great post on Times and Seasons by Nate Oman, where he talked about why virginity and chastity being equated was a really bad idea and non-theological. And he went through a lot of the things I've talked about, which I think, can be common sense. But his notion that he finally came down to was that chastity is about the fact that our bodies don't belong to us. Our bodies belong to God. And so therefore, if you believe in God and you believe that God has said that this is the rule and this is not a rule that can be changed, then, obviously that belief is what will lead you to making chaste choices. And as I thought that through, I found it really incomplete, kind of disturbing. Because, as you know, women's bodies not belonging to ourselves is another feminist problem. As a man, I think it's a lot easier to say your body doesn't belong to you, your body belongs to somebody else, because men's bodies never really have belonged to somebody else. Whereas for women, that's a historical reality. I guess slavery men, but for the most part, white men's bodies have never belonged to anybody else. As a woman, I can't just say, oh, my body isn't mine. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to God. Therefore, I have to live a chaste life. Even if I do believe in chastity, as a feminist, I cannot say that to anybody. And so I think as I thought about it more and as I went into the what is it I believe theologically about chastity? It came down to, once again, the paradox. The church has, once again, on the obedience and personal revelation scale, right? These things are a paradox, and we believe in both of them, and I think that's the point. There is a paradox between obedience and personal revelation for a reason. The church has a vested interest in stressing obedience, because obedience ties us to the church. Obedience gets them what they want.
basically.
And so, but I think theologically, we of the quirky Mormon variety tend to overemphasize the personal revelation. Personally, I've really struggled figuring out, well, when does obedience apply? Because I believe in the paradox. But for the most part, I'm like, you know, whatever my personal revelation tells me, that's what I'm going to do. You know, so when does the obedience portion of that kick in? And interestingly, as I've been coming to the conclusion that that obedience portion kicks in because we also do need to belong in a society. But it's when we overemphasize the obedience that we have a problem. We need sometimes to sacrifice things that are personally important to us in order to for the community to be functional. And in fact, one of the biggest problems, I think, of American society is this focus on rugged individualism. And we can all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And that's not true. Like, we have to be responsible to the community. We have to help each other. And when communities are healthy, and when we have a balance between personal needs and community needs, then we're in the middle of that paradox where we need to be. And, you know, the language we use for that in the Mormon Church is obedience. And I think the language that we need to use when we come to chastity and speaking of it in a healthy, empowered way has to be, once again, that balance between my body belongs to me, unequivocally. This is my body. You can't tell me what to do with it at all. But God did create this body. And I would like to honor God with my choices. And it's my choice, and it has to be my choice, or it's not empowered. If I'm just doing it to be obedient, if I'm just doing it out of fear of shame, if I'm just doing it because I know that I'll never be clean again, if I'm just doing it because I'll never find a husband and I'll never be happy, none of those reasons are a good reason to live the law of chastity. It has to be an empowered choice that you make because you want to honor God. And I understand that that might not be the choice that everybody believes honors God. But if you do have faith in chastity, I think that, you know, finding, once again, the center of that paradox where we can own that our bodies are our own and that they're a gift from God, that is where we can find a teaching that will teach an empowered chastity that allows girls to make choices based on what they want and what they feel is right for their bodies. You know, chastity is really important to Mormons, and we really hate the way that sexuality is treated in modern culture. I personally, as a feminist and as a Mormon, I'm just sick of the way that women's bodies are hypersexualized and sick of the way that manhood is portrayed as this beer-chugging, sex-obsessed, you know. I'm just tired of it all. And so I do think that chastity is a tool that Mormons can use in order to teach an empowered, morally upright, and communally responsible approach to sex. And I think that we have to change the way, as Mormons, we have to change the way we're approaching this, because we have too many Mormon women who are completely uncomfortable in their sexuality, too many Mormon women who can't have a healthy sex life even after they're married because of all the shame and all the guilt that were given to them because we teach so many, because of the fear and the ignorance, we teach so many untrue and unhelpful approaches to chastity. I lost my thread. You know, Mormonism is a deeply body positive religion. We have a deeply body positive theology. We just have to really be thoughtful about the way we approach the ideas of sexuality, because they're just too fraught and too delicate, and we're doing too much harm.
And now we'll open the the question portion. If you have a question, we'll go ahead and repeat it so the Sunstone recording devices pick up the question up here in the microphones. And we have about 10 minutes for questions. Go ahead.
Love your presentation.
Thanks.
I don't agree with your assumptions about the male sexuality in the Mormon Church. I feel sorry for Mormon boys.
I actually really feel sorry for Mormon boys too.
Because of the standard that you talked about applying to both men and women in the Mormon Church, I love the point that you're making. I feel like it would be better to talk about purity than chastity. Me, chastity means just exactly what most people think it means. I haven't had sexual intercourse yet. That's the definition of chastity. So rather than redefining chastity, my suggestion is what we need to look at the church members is redefining purity. Because there's all kinds of definitions of what purity means in the book of Leviticus. And if you read the book of Leviticus, you will find out that men and women, before they could go to the temple and offer their sacrifices, there were all kinds of rules and regulations purity that no Christian religion, including Mormonism, follows anymore. So I think it's much easier for us to redefine purity than it is for us to redefine the chastity.
Yeah, I like your point that I didn't go enough into the way that chastity is taught to boys, and it is taught to boys in very unhealthy ways, especially the assumption that there's something deeply flawed in boys and that they only want one thing. Like, it just makes me sick to think that my son is going to go into young men's and learn that, you know, that he's deeply flawed and the girls need to protect his virtue for him because he can't do it for himself because he's an animal that can't control his own passions.
That's a true position. We are deeply flawed. We desperately need women to help us.
We are all deeply flawed. We desperately need each other.
To comment on that, like, I'm the crazy sexual one in my marriage. Like, my husband's the demure, pure, like, oh, let's just spoon and cuddle. And I'm one that's like, get in there. I think that, you know, we're just switched. I think that, you know, each person has their own differences in the verse, like, well, that is purity. Isn't that for rituals?
When you went to the Jewish temple or something, there were certain things. You can't have had your period recently, and women were excluded from the temple after they'd given birth to a female child.
Yeah,
longer than
like
after they'd given birth to a male child. And if a man had a seminal emission, he couldn't go to the temple and offer his sacrifice.
Yeah,
I mean, there were just all kinds of rituals.
That kiss is awesome. I think a lot of our Mormon focus outward at judging others, like, the world is so scary, and those people, they're making all these bad choices. And a lot of the ways that we focus outward, and even the way that we apply stories outwardly and parables outwardly, needs to be shifted to an inward focus. Because if we shift the focus of purity inward and we say, you know, are my intentions pure? They're never going to be. But, you know, at least am I aware of where my intentions aren't pure? And am I trying to correct for that? You know, rather than just presuming, well, of course my intentions are pure, I'm on God's side, and He agrees with me all the time. You know, and so, And I feel that way about pretty much every Sunday school lesson we have. I'm like, well, you know, that lesson that, you know, that there's good and evil in the world, I think that lesson works when we apply it internally, because there's all good and evil in all of us, and if we're trying to strive for the good, then we're always going to be getting better. If we're constantly looking at other people's bad and talking about our own good, then we're going to be going to work. Yeah.
I feel like for people, though, I guess just like being able to deconstruct what sexuality is so people do not have the hang-ups, the guilt, the emotional trauma, and the manipulation, feeling like they are pure enough, they are good enough, they are unworthy of God's love. That's something that really needs to happen and be embraced.
Yes.
Lisa, give us your recommendation. Should Mormon women book groups read Shades of Grey and enjoy it?
I was thinking it might work for you.
You don't want to repeat my sex question.
So Lisa, give us your recommendation. Should Mormon women book groups read Shades of Grey and enjoy it?
I haven't read.
Would that be helping?
Yeah. I haven't read Shades of Grey myself, so I don't really know. I have friends that have read it, though, and thought it was hilarious. So I think that, you know, literature that explores a healthy sexuality can be really, really useful for women in married relationships. Because I just know a lot of women who, you know, after having babies and working all day and being tired, you know, reading a little bit of romancy stuff can really light up the fire for everybody in the relationship, right? And so, you know, I think that, once again, there's always got to be a balance between stuff that is useful and helpful and has good, you know, good, healthy representations of sexuality, and that's going to vary widely for individuals. Like, what's going to feel healthy for one person is not going to feel healthy and wise for another. But I think that, you know, using the tools that are at our disposal that aren't degrading and that don't hurt other people, and I think literature is one of those things. You know, I have a real problem with pornography because it hurts so many people, but literature doesn't hurt anybody, and I think that it can be a real helpful tool for a lot of married couples, or a lot of sexually active couples, really, in general. But we're talking a lot of context here, so.
Your concept of virginity not necessarily equaling purity has brought to mind, and I need help with this, it's a legend that I have heard of more than once, and I just am asking for clarification on this. A story of a test of virginity that was applied by a gentleman seeking the most pure woman to marry. And this test was the unicorn would lay his head in the lap of the most virtuous or pure woman. Does anyone know this?
Some symbols of heaven.
And there were two women that he was choosing between. One young woman had been abused and I'm probably making up the details here because I just remember the overall point of it. A woman who had lost her virginity in some way that apparently was not of her choice. The other one was a woman who retained her virginity but was cruel, was manipulative, not what we would consider a virtuous woman in matters of social relationships. And as the community gathered to watch this test, the unicorn went and lay his head in the lap of the young woman whose virginity had been taken from her. And, of course, the community was surprised, and the gentleman was delighted because that's the woman he loved in the first place. Does anyone remember this story? I'm not making it up. I had heard
it. Sounds like a pretty good myth.
But as I say, your concept is not a new one. It's it's been around.
Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun. Nothing new.
Question here and there, and we have time. It's your turn, and one more.
Lisa, thank you for your presentation. In thinking about teaching young women a more empowered concept of this, I find a problem with language. And in particular, I don't like the word worthy, because if there's a worthy young woman, then there's an unworthy young woman. And I don't think any, you know, no human being is unworthy.
I just hate that application. Do you have any suggestions for better language, for better words that we can use? Because, you know, if you look in a lesson manual, the word worthy is used, you know, 100 times. So yeah. where do you start with that language reconstruction?
That is a really good question. I haven't thought about it a lot. I would say that it might be a useful thing to talk about feeling repentant or feeling or like striving, you know, like that kind of thing where it's about our intentions and it's about our goals, shifting it away from anything that anytime any of the language is applied to like a girl's past or her history, it's always going to be problematic because there's so many girls that have had, you know, who have had experiences that make them feel dirty because of the way our culture is and because of how unfair life is. And so, you know, like any language that can talk about how you are choosing to move forward, how you are choosing to, you know, how you are choosing to go forward and how you want to make good decisions and how you want to be thoughtful about the way that you approach things and you want to, you know, heal yourself and others and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think, you know, shifting that away, that shifting that kind of concept from like an external judginess to an internal striving kind of language.
That. Well, about meets the present criteria for rather than worthy, compliant.
There's one last question.
Of course, it's not a question. I just really appreciate your presentation, and I just wanted to concur with the idea of language and how we approach it. And I think it's so easy to get into dualistic language, good, bad, black, white, etc. And I think that, and I know this or I don't know this, I think that would be the basis of approaching language, is to not go into the duality. And also good literature. And I find a huge difference between good and bad literature, and I show you that I haven't read it, that I've had reports that it's extremely poorly written, which I don't like. But I think good literature, what people are seeking, where they're really looking at the language, is an essential part of what you're talking about. And as we speak, I think we need to be mindful of what we are applying when we say pure, when we say chaste, all those things.
Right. And I think we really have to just shift. You know, like, I understand that some people don't like those notions at all, and I think that that's a legitimate, you know, like, sort of choice to make. But if we're talking about, you know, trying to move forward with Mormon culture, just completely rejecting those notions, it isn't going to work. You know, we have to learn to reapply the language in a way that can be healthier and that can be more empowering.
Thank you. Thanks very much.